As we'll all know from our own experience, decisions of the administrative court, particularly when finding against the government, are often subjected to the charge that they're the product of judicial activism, that judges have overreached their constitutional powers in either to impermissibly develop the law or even to create it. And as we see in the United States, where charges of those natures are more frequently levelled, and they're levelled in the context of a system in which many of their judges are elected judges, it's a charge that is capable of lowering the reputation of the judiciary in the eyes of the public. So what does judicial overreach mean? Does an analysis of actual judgments rather than Daily Mail editorials demonstrate its actual existence? And what are the proper limits of judicial power under our unwritten constitution? There is no one better or more qualified to discuss these issues than Professor Mark Elliott, Professor of Public Law at Cambridge, Fellow of St. Catharines, author of many of the leading public law textbooks, and editor of the blog Public Law for Everyone. In a PLP conference, hard to think of a better title for a blog. Professor Elliott.
Well, thank you for inviting me to talk to you this afternoon. As we've heard, the idea of judicial overreach is a very controversial one, and I think it can mean a lot of different things. And I want to be clear about what I am not going to talk about this afternoon before I go on to talk about the things I am going to talk about. I think if we think about judicial overreach in its most obvious guise, then we would think about straightforward judicial lawmaking, most obviously through the development of the common law in a sort of aggressively activist way. And in constitutional terms, we would think then about a tension between the judiciary and the legislature. And that, I think, is a rich theme, but not one that I'm going to mine this afternoon. I think the second sense of judicial overreach is the one that was just alluded to, and that would be where we find judicial review cases where the court takes a notably interventionist stance, raising a tension between the judiciary and the executive. In that context, I always think a good example is the Coughlin case, an instance, as it happens, of judicial lawmaking, because that was the first time the courts unambiguously accepted a doctrine of substantive legitimate expectations, but in doing so adopted a proportionality or balancing test in a way and applied it in a manner which arguably caused the court to trespass on the merits. As everybody will know, the Supreme Court, I think, is appears to be building up to a review of the law in the area of proportionality, as mentioned in the FAM judgment and others last year. And so that's a question that will play out, I think, in the Supreme Court in the next year or two to come. But I want to actually think about a third kind of judicial overreach today, and that's what I would call judicial constitution making. I think what's distinctive about this is that it impacts not just on the legislature and not just on the executive. I think that it brings the judiciary potentially into tension with each of those two branches. And moreover, it also shapes the relationship between those two branches. And so I think that this is perhaps judicial overreach writ large, if that's what we think it is. Now, my aim this afternoon isn't to try, in the 25 minutes that I've got, to try to define exactly where I think the boundaries of judicial authority lie. That sounds like the subject for a much larger piece of work. What I want to try to do is two things. Firstly, to try to calibrate the case law in this area to make us think more critically about where and how we draw the line. And secondly, to explore the reasons why there is so much disagreement in this area. So I want to do that by reference to three contexts. The first is the judicial development of the notion of constitutional statutes or legislation. We see that beginning in the judgment of Lord Justice Laws in Thoburn back in 2002, and we see the Supreme Court run with that idea and develop it in the HS2 judgment from a couple of years ago. Secondly, the notion of embedded, perhaps deeply embedded, constitutional values, an idea that we see in older cases like Annus Minic, but also I think particularly in the recent judgment of the Supreme Court in Evans and the Attorney General, and I will say a bit about that case in particular later. And then thirdly, the notion that there might be constitutional values which are not simply deeply embedded and resistant to legislative disturbance, but constitutional values which are in fact impervious to legislative removal. Ideas that we see hints of, at least, in Supreme Court judgments or House of Lords judgments like Jackson and Muin. So let me work through those three contexts and then try to draw some conclusions. The conventional view, the received wisdom, as Dicey told us more than 100 years ago, is that all acts of Parliament are equal, that neither the Act of Union with Scotland nor the Dentist Act 1878 has more claim than the other to be considered a supreme law. In Thoburn and Sunderland City Council, in the context of trying to tease out why it might be that European Union law, at least for now, has priority, Lord Justice Laws developed the notion of constitutional statutes. The European Communities Act, he said, took priority over other legislation because it was a constitutional act, and ordinary statutes would have to give way to it unless they sought to explicitly or specifically repeal or override it. That seems to me an act of judicial constitution making in the sense that it takes an established constitutional principle, the principle of implied repeal, and it significantly modifies it. The principle of implied repeal lies at the heart of the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, and here we have a judge who is doing something quite innovative and making law, making constitutional law around that idea. Now, the consequences that follow from this are relatively modest. All that we're saying is that constitutional statutes can't be impliedly repealed. They can still be explicitly repealed. But I think that the judgment in Thoburn lays the foundation for perhaps a more thoroughgoing idea along these lines. And in fact, we see that develop in the HS2 judgment. As you probably know, the issue here, or one of them, was as to whether or not the parliamentary process being adopted in respect of the HS2 planning process was compatible with EU law. That raised the question whether judicial scrutiny of the adequacy of that parliamentary process would lead to a breach of Article 9 of the Bill of Rights, which confers privileged status on parliamentary proceedings. That then raised the further question whether even if the court would be having to do something incompatible with Article 9 of the Bill of Rights, it would simply have to get on and do it because European law required it to do so and European Union law had priority. Now, in the end, the Supreme Court resolved this case at one of the earlier stages, and so the treatment of these issues is essentially obiter. But the treatment is nevertheless interesting. In a judgment that was supported by the whole of the panel, it was said that the EC Act was not to be taken to have given EU law priority sufficient to override Article 9 of the Bill of Rights, because the Bill of Rights had a fundamental constitutional status that was even more fundamental than that of the EC Act. What we see here, then, is the Supreme Court articulating the notion that there isn't simply a hierarchy of statutes between constitutional and ordinary statutes, but a hierarchy within the subset of constitutional statutes, that some, like the Bill of Rights, are super-constitutional, whereas the EC Act is merely constitutional in nature. That seems to me, again, to be an act of judicial constitution-making, in the sense that the court is determining the extent to which legislation is subject to the normal consequences of parliamentary sovereignty, namely implied repeal. One of the things that I think makes these cases relatively uncontroversial, at least relative to the other cases that I'll talk about, is that in making these decisions, the courts are simply ranking legislation enacted by Parliament. And in that sense, we might not think of the court being on any kind of collision course with the legislature, because they're simply determining the constitutional significance of different pieces of legislation. I think the picture changes when we think about what I would call embedded constitutional values, an idea that we encounter, for example, in the Anna's Minute case, where, as we all know, the ouster clause protected determinations, but the House of Lords read the ouster clause extraordinarily narrowly, such that it only protected valid determinations within jurisdiction. What's going on here beneath the surface is relatively clear, that the court is trying to balance the principle of the sovereignty of Parliament on the one hand and the demands of the rule of law on the other hand, and it's presented to us as an interpretive exercise. But whether we're satisfied that it's an interpretive exercise, given its consequence, is to largely, if not at that time, when there was still the possibility of non-jurisdictional errors on the face of the record, whether we're satisfied that an interpretation that largely empties the provision of content really is just an interpretation is an important question. More recently, indeed last year in Evans and the Attorney General, I think that the Supreme Court did something quite similar, and it certainly attracted considerable criticism. This was the case in which the government decided that it would not implement the upper tribunal's order to disclose Prince Charles's advocacy correspondence. The government exercised the veto power in Section 53 of the Freedom of Information Act, and that decision to use the veto power was then judicially reviewed. Now, the majority of judges split into two groups, but the larger of those two groups, consisting of three of the justices, took a very sharp knife to the statute. And they took a discretionary power to veto the upper tribunal's decision. And they said that it could only be exercised in extraordinarily limited circumstances, if there had been a change of circumstances or if the decision was demonstrably flawed. Lord Neuberger, giving the judgment of the larger majority group, said that this interpretation was justified because a broad override power would cut across fundamental components of the rule of law. So we see that embedded values are highly resistant to legislative disturbance. And then the courts raise a tantalising prospect, but one that they never explicitly follow through on, of the possibility not just of embedded, but of impervious constitutional values. Jackson, I guess, is the most obvious example of this, where, apropos of nothing in particular, Lord Steyne said that a pure and absolute conception of sovereignty is out of place in modern Britain. Well, of course, if sovereignty isn't absolute, it's not sovereignty. Lord Hope said that parliamentary sovereignty no longer, if it ever was absolute. And Lady Hale, calling to mind the attempt the year before to insert an anosmic-proof ouster clause into the then Asylum and Immigration Bill, said that courts might reject an attempt to subvert the rule of law by ousting judicial review. Lord Hodge took up this theme 2 years ago in the case of Muin, a case about the right to vote, and he said that it was possible that if Parliament abusively tried to entrench its power by curtailing the franchise, then the common law, informed by principles of democracy, the rule of law, and international norms, would perhaps be able to declare such legislation unlawful. I think that raises two questions. One question is, would it constitute judicial overreach if a court actually went ahead and did one of these things? A highly hypothetical question, but one to which I think most people would think the answer was yes. But it raises a second question as well, which is whether it constitutes judicial overreach to simply raise the prospect of doing those things. saying these things, putting these ideas out there, seems to me in itself to be a kind of judicial constitution-making, because it is a shot across the bows of Parliament, and it is the judges saying to Parliament, think carefully before you go down this route, because we're not promising that we will respect a piece of legislation enacted in these sorts of terms. What I think we see then through these three examples is two things. Firstly, as we work through them, the degree of resistance increases, the degree to which things are resistant to legislation is enhanced. At the first level, at constitutional statutes, we're simply saying that there's no implied repeal, although it seems from HS2 that there are degrees here and that some things are even harder to repeal than others. Then we meet embedded values, which are clearly resistant, and Evans would suggest highly resistant to legislative disturbance. And then there might be things which are entirely resistant. But I think we also see a second progression as we move through the three categories. And the progression is that as we move along that line, we move further and further away from the court doing something that has to do with the intention of Parliament. Constitutional statutes are simply about implementing the intention of one Parliament over another. Embedded constitutional values are about the extent to which parliamentary intention can be moulded through the application of interpretive presumptions. And the stronger those presumptions are, the further we move away from actually applying what Parliament intended. And of course, at the third stage, we put parliamentary intention to one side and say this is something that Parliament simply isn't allowed to do. Let me finish by suggesting that there are two different ways of looking at this, and that these two different ways of looking at these questions either help us to decide where we think the line should be, or at least help us to understand why drawing the line and agreeing on where the line that marks the limit of judicial authority is such a contentious matter. And I'd like to illustrate this point by going back to the Evans judgment. I think the minority judgments in Evans, where the justices took the view that the Attorney General had acted perfectly lawfully in exercising the veto power and were not prepared to limit it in the way that the larger group of the majority were, what that demonstrates, I think, is that they are looking at the Constitution through a lens that consists principally of the idea of parliamentary sovereignty. They're not ignoring the fact that there are other fundamental principles in play, most obviously the rule of law and the separation of powers, but their understanding of the content and implications of those principles are coloured by their application of this initial filter of parliamentary sovereignty. And we can see that reflected in both of the dissenting judgments. In his judgment, Lord Wilson was talking about the judgment of the Court of Appeal, I think out of politeness, because in fact the Court of Appeal came to a view that for present purposes was highly similar to the view of the larger majority group in the Supreme Court. He said that in reaching its decision, the Court of Appeal did not, in my view, interpret Section 53, it rewrote it. It invoked precious constitutional principles, but among the most precious is that of parliamentary sovereignty, emblematic of our democracy. So the other principles that were in play had to play second fiddle to parliamentary sovereignty. For Lord Hughes, the rule of law is of first importance, but, and it's an important but, it is an integral part of the rule of law that courts give effect to parliamentary intention. The rule of law is not the same as a rule that courts must always prevail, no matter what the statute says. So again, Lord Hughes isn't airbrushing the rule of law out of the constitutional picture, but what it means to him is heavily coloured by his priority given to parliamentary sovereignty. A second view, and I think the view that characterises the approach of the larger majority group, sees the three fundamental principles of our constitution in a different kind of relationship. No longer on this view is the sovereignty of Parliament the primary principle, but rather the three principles exist together and in relation with each other, and each colours the meaning of the other. if we think about the rule of law, it's perfectly true, as was pointed out, that it implies a judicial obligation to apply the law, including statute law enacted by Parliament. But it's equally true that the rule of law implies a fundamental judicial obligation to serve as the arbiter of legal disputes and an obligation to hold the executive to account for the lawful exercise of its powers. It's also true that the rule of law would view with great suspicion a ministerial discretion and a wide discretion to override the judgment of a superior court of record. Looked at in that way, with less of a parliamentary sovereignty filter applied, the rule of law has more to say in relation to a case like Evans. And a similar point can be made in relation to the separation of powers. It's true, it ascribes legislative power to Parliament and gives Parliament the power to choose to which institutions functions should be allocated. It can allocate a ministerial override power to the Attorney General if it wishes to. But the separation of powers also ascribes a judicial function to the judiciary, and it casts great doubts on the legitimacy of the executive power to override judicial decisions. And so I think ultimately it's a question of the relative priority that we give to these three principles as to whether or not we would think that a case like Evans causes the court to exceed the limits of judicial authority. For what it's worth, my own view is that Evans doesn't imply judicial overreach, and that it demonstrates that the content and scope of each of these principles is not just contestable, but context-sensitive, and that the strength of the claims that each presents can only be considered and determined within the context of an individual case. That's not to say that it's unarguable that Evans amounts to overreach. But I think that looking at things in this way perhaps helps to sort of explain and to help us to frame the question as to what we consider overreach to amount to in the first place. So I don't have a simple answer for what judicial overreach means, but I think that when we think about this question, it's important to be aware of the contestability of the principles that are in play, and that questions about judicial power essentially reduced to a disagreement about how those principles relate to each other and whether or not we think one of them has preponderant weight or whether they exist in this relational sense. Thank you.
Mark, thank you so much for that masterly overview of the issues. We've got a few minutes for questions. Yes. I think someone's hopefully going to come with a microphone for you so that we can, because I can hear it, Mark can hear it, but I suspect not everybody at the back. Just at the front here. Yeah. Thanks.
My question is regards to sort of the triggering of Article 50. There's an issue of Theresa May not sort of giving Parliament the opportunity to perform its function of scrutiny. So what would you say, how would you say that affects sort of the idea of parliamentary sovereignty in a modern sort of setting?
I don't think that the Article 50 case that the High Court will begin to hear tomorrow directly implicates these issues, actually. I think one of the, and I'm not sure if any of the relevant parties are here, but one of the surprising things to me about the government skeleton argument is that they are making a judicial overreach argument. They're suggesting that the question the High Court is being asked is non-justiciable because the prerogative in question, the foreign policy prerogative, is one that raises matters of high policy. I fail to see how that can possibly be the case, because nobody is asking the court to rule on whether or not the policy arguments, the merits of exercising the prerogative, play out one way or the other. The question is a simple, or at least a hard question of law, whether the prerogative exists in this context in the first place. But there's also an overreach argument that the government makes, according to the skeleton, in that it says that if the court finds for the claimants and says that legislation is required, then that will trespass on parliamentary privilege because it will effectively require Parliament to legislate. And again, I simply fail to see the logic of that argument. That would suggest that every time the court tells the government it hasn't got the power to do something, it is forcing Parliament to legislate in order to give the government that power, and that argument is simply illogical. So there have been attempts by the government to dress this Article 50 question up in terms that would lend themselves to allegations of judicial overreach. But for my own part, I find them entirely unconvincing.
Well, I'm afraid whenever I hear this kind of masterly scholarly overview fairly setting out the issues, I always have this kind of temptation to go, yeah, but what do you think? So let me take this. I mean, let's look at the kind of Jackson-Mouhan really hard line. Parliament puts in train an act that deprives vast sections of the population of the right to vote. So the notion of parliamentary sovereignty, because it's democratic, the immediate tension there. The courts, would it be unconstitutional for the courts to override, to declare that unlawful?
Well, the short answer is I don't know. I think the longer answer is it's not really an answer at all. But I think to go back to the question I asked myself instead of the question you're asking me now is about the distinction between the court actually taking that step and threatening to take that step. And I think that's a really important distinction because I, for my own part, I think that issuing the kind of veiled threat that one sees in a case like Jackson or Mouhan, I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing for the court to do because I think it contributes to a sort of an institutional understanding between the judiciary and the political branches as to where the lines of demarcation are. And I think one simply has to hope that that kind of thing means that the sort of situation you're outlining just never happens. I mean, the great risk of the court doing the kind of thing it threatens is that in the end, there is the risk that the court comes off worse and it suffers a massive loss of authority. And I would expect any Supreme Court justice to think, you know, very, very long and hard before taking that kind of step. But suggesting or hinting that they might consider doing this, I think is a different question.
Well, Mark, thank you very much indeed for an absolutely fantastic overview. Thank you very much.